Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show. My name is Don Allen. The Studio A and Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, it's a beautiful, beautiful Wednesday evening. How are you, sir?
I can't complain, Mr. Allen, here in Studio B. And yes, in fact, the temperature has been about 10 to 15 degrees higher. We would have thought that we were in the latter part of March, maybe even the first week of April. Yeah. Now we're going to get a little winter weather. That's what they're talking about. But then this is Minnesota, and we always get a big blizzard or snowstorm during the basketball tournament. So that could be in about 3 weeks. But I don't know. This ground is pretty warm out there, so it makes it kind of hard for the kind of cold sleet and et cetera. But we will find out pretty quick, if you will. But, hey, the temperature was rising all across the country last night. I understand you Republicans and those Democrats and et cetera out there caucusing, if you will, getting ready to see who's going to be the nominee of their respective parties. I understand you got an update for us, Don. You were you're a precinct chairman, is that right?
Yeah, as of last night, I'm precinct chair 41 out here in Columbia Heights, and it was really shocking, Mr. Edwards. As you know, I'm in my early 50s, and I think I was not only one of the three or four black people out there, but I was probably the youngest guy in the place. And and so I posed the question to the Republicans after I read letters by Rubio, Trump, and others, Carson, who actually sent these letters for you to read to your precinct folks. You know, I asked the question, is the Minnesota GOP going to be extinct by November? Meaning that, you know, I saw people being pushed in wheelchairs, and it was very non-exciting, for lack of a better word. So I understand. I've talked with the Secretary and a couple other people inside of the Minnesota GOP who say they're still $1.2 million in debt. They courted Rubio to open a office here, and he's the only candidate they courted. And so, and it was shown last night that there are a lot of people out for Rubio, but Cruz in our particular precinct, Cruz at 12, got 12 votes. Trump got 8, then Carson got 2, and the rest of them got 0. That were on the ballot.
Well, what did Rubio get?
And so, Rubio, I think 4.
You said Cruz. You started out with Cruz, then Trump,
yeah,
then
that's
Carson,
right. Cruz,
and then
they were pushing Rubio. Rubio did well in other precincts that were involved in this, but in SD 41, the precinct that I was at, Cruz got 12 points, Trump got 8, and Ben Carson got 2, and then Rubio, I think, got 4, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, I'm actually looking for the ballot stuff here. So, I mean, he didn't do well in our group, but in other sections, in other Senate districts out here, Columbia Heights,
you said points. You meant votes, right? Not points.
I meant votes.
Votes.
Mm-hmm. And so it was pretty interesting to see that. And there's a big push by the Minnesota GOP for people not to support Donald Trump, Republican, even if he is the nominee. So I found that very interesting, very insightful, and just letting me know that these folks are planning on eating their young and being extinct by November 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my experience last night. It was not a good thing because, you know,
Minnesota GOP has been boasting that, you know, we've talked to Somalis, we talked to African Americans, and they're all coming out to the precincts. Well, you know, I know a lot of there's Somalians in Columbia Heights and Fridley, and for that Republican caucus, they were not there. So, and
you think that
like
they went over to the Democratic caucuses, and so they basically wandered away from the Republicans?
Well, from what I said,
think that's what happened.
Well, from what I was told by some friends that went to the Democratic caucus, that it was packed, and a lot of the folks were right there supporting Bernie Sanders, as instructed by Congressman Keith Ellison, and he did win. So, but yeah, I think that's where they were. And I know a lot of libertarians and GOP types did their first DFL caucus last night. And they've proudly posted it on social media. And so there's a change in tide. We'll see what happens, though, Mr. Edwards.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Now, didn't Carson drop out today? I understood he dropped out, or is he still in?
You know,
I
have not. I don't know. I have not had the news
okay.
on.
Well, maybe you check your computer there to see if there's any breaking news or posting. I know they're trying to do everything they can to get him and the governor of Ohio State, Kasich, out, but I think they're gonna quote unquote stay, if you will. I mean, they have every right to stay until
they
change the rules, if you will. You mentioned Congressman Ellison, his support for Sanders. That is a feather in his cap that though he is a congressman representing a congressional district, still, you know, he can take credit for helping to carry Minnesota into the Bernie Sanders column, if you will. And so that gives him some level of clout, because I understand that Elijah Cummings and some of the veteran Democratic legislators are not very happy with his support of Bernie Sanders over Hillary Clinton. So that'll be interesting to watch, though I don't think there's any serious challenger to Congressman Ellison. no one is quote-unquote in place, and it's going to be difficult for somebody to get in place now, because we're tending to forget we're already into March of 2016.
Yes.
And so we're all pumped up. Let me ask you this question, Don. Did it come up in your Republican caucus last night, the statements by challenger, or in this case, contender Trump, about the issue of supremacists and David Duke and et cetera? Was there any discussion?
Actually, it did not. It did not at all. No one discussed that.
How many black folk were in there? You said obviously you were there, and how many more?
Well, for my Senate district, I was the only one in there, Mr. Edwards. So I was by my lonesome, sitting with my back against the wall in the front.
Okay.
So, yeah, that was it.
Wow. So
yeah.
No one raised that question. You're aware of what I'm specifically talking about, though, as it pertains to the Donald, that he says, you know, that he really is not aware of white supremacists in America. I don't know how... People could take that. That's clearly a person who does not understand history of America. That would kind of concern me, because he doesn't know much about foreign policy. Now he doesn't know much about American history. I have, you know, trembling visions of him answering that red phone if he becomes president at 3 a.m. in the morning. Wrong decision, and none of us will be here. But that's interesting. No discussion about his changing the spot, because he initially said on Saturday that he didn't support what the white supremacists were talking about, and particularly David Duke. And then on Sunday, he really changed up. So, but anyways, maybe some calls or something will come in about that. But the die is set. And clearly, you know, there's going to be some real catfighting in the Democratic Party also. All right, what else we got?
Well, we do have
phone lines
statement.
Open early on, particularly because of the caucuses and et cetera, and with Minnesota going for Bernie Sanders, you know, because we've got a lot of Clinton supporters and et cetera, and it'd be interesting to see what their observations were about Bernie Sanders, because Bernie has been having problems. He's been struggling. We saw this in South Carolina with being able to really identify with African Americans. You know what I mean? And really knowing the history. He says he's been involved with the civil rights movement, et cetera. You know, Representative Lewis of Georgia called him out and said he never saw him anywhere. So, you know, that didn't set well. But I know that groups, the young millenniums, as they call themselves, seem to be strong supporters of his. That's why I'm saying I'm surprised that some of them didn't strategically position themselves in the Republican caucuses last night, like out in your community, to raise the question about a presidential candidate who doesn't know anything about white supremacy in America and doesn't know about David Duke. So, all right. Well, you know, maybe some folks will go in.
Mr. Edwards, I did find the official statement by Dr. Ben Carson, who said, it's just a paragraph, excuse me, it says, I've decided not to attend the Fox News GOP presidential debate tomorrow night in Detroit, even though I will not be in my hometown of Detroit on Thursday. I remain deeply committed to my home nation, America. I do not see a political path forward in light of last evening's Super Tuesday primary results. However, this grassroots movement on behalf of We the People will continue. Along with millions of patriots who have supported my campaign for president, I remain committed to saving America for future generations. We must not depart from our goals to restore God and our founders' intention for this exceptional nation. I appreciate the support. Ben Carson. And that was his statement. He is officially out of the race as a 7-year-old.
All right, so my sources were correct earlier today with me from the West Coast. So Ben Carson has dropped out, and so that basically leaves four, including the governor of Ohio State, Cruz, Rubio, and, of course, the Donald. Well, that'll be interesting to see what happens. I'm interested in what the thinking of African-Americans here in Minnesota is with regards to his statements about having no knowledge whatsoever about white supremacists, doesn't know anything about it, doesn't know anything about David Duke, and et cetera. So I'm interested as it pertains to that. But anyways, pull that phone number out, Don, so folks know
our
phone lines are open.
Yes, phone lines are open, 347-426-3904. Again, 347-426-3904. Mr. Edwards, we do have a caller, and let me get the caller up and ready to go here.
Okay.
Stand by. Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Hey, Mr.
Fine, sir. I think this sounds like, is this Mr. Nelson?
This is.
Okay.
Good evening.
What can we do for you this evening?
I like you, Mr. Edwards, am befuddled the fact that Don, that you too, my brother, have not denounced your support of a dude that is denounced and played ignorant to the fact of not knowing the statements of David Duke, or knowing David Duke, when in fact David Duke was the reason why he didn't join the Reform Party, because Jesse Ventura, in fact, left the Reform Party, and so David Duke joined. So Donald decided not to join the Reform Party because David Duke was joining. So he absolutely knows him, and he absolutely was aware of what he said. In fact, he laid out two crap explanations of, one, he couldn't hear his the earpiece in his ear, couldn't hear, and then the second one, he was on the phone, and it was a bad reception. I don't know how anyone can continue. I'm just surprised that anybody, especially blacks,
Let me pass this by you, okay? Hillary Clinton made a statement about young black gang members and said they need to heal, H-E-E-L.
You mean heal like a dog or heal
like
a dog.
Done.
Person suffering
heal like a dog. First of all, like a dog.
Stop that.
We need to be clear. That was what in 1996.
You are.
No, we're going back and we're talking about Donald Trump.
You are being just as typical as any other Republican. First of all, stop that because that's not true. You use YouTube.
It is true.
And show me.
Can
I finish? Show me in the video where she was referring, ever referred to black men or black people in general. When she next thing you're going to tell me is that she meant to call them the super predators too. She didn't say let's not continue to perpetuate those lies about her.
I'm getting ready to send it to you because I've had it right here on my computer waiting for
Don,
this golden moment.
I've seen it a couple of hundred times. It's the same video that you and other Bernie Sanders supporters try to use to persuade others that she hates blacks. When, in fact, during the Clinton administration, blacks continued to do well. When Bill Clinton took over, the unemployment rate for African Americans was at 14.9. When he left, because he created a good economy, it was at 8.2. So then you talk about the crimes bill that Bernie Sanders supported and voted for, Donald Trump supported.
Donald Trump wasn't even a politician.
Yeah, see, if you don't know much about your candidate, don't speak up. He himself spoke about the crimes bill. He was asked about it by John Cowell of ABC, and he himself spoke about the crimes bill, bruh. So what I'm saying is
you're talking about recently. You're talking about recently.
Yes.
Yeah, I understand that. But when the bill, what, 96, if I'm not mistaken?
94.
Donald Trump was not a politician. Well, 94 even. Donald Trump was not a politician.
He ain't one now.
Gentlemen, it is interesting listening to you guys going at it. Now, let me just go back. I just need to say the statement about heel. Now, wasn't that made by Hillary Clinton in 1996? That wasn't something she said in the last number of weeks, was it?
No, that's what I'm referencing it from. She said it in 1996. We have to bring them to heel. Talking about the black gays.
Now you're asserting that she was telling black folks to heal like Rover.
Mr. Nelson, yes, exactly.
Yes, sir.
But here goes my deal.
Okay.
We as black folks get upset, rightfully so in some cases, of these particular comments coming out of these three or four people. Okay. My question to the black community in general, and y'all can call and beat me up or challenge me or whatever you want to do. The phone lines are open. When are you going to get upset when the MCA2 scores come out and you find that Native Americans have surpassed the black kids in the Minnesota in these public schools where they have less than 20% proficiency in reading, math, and science? When are you going to get mad about something like that? You know, and I'm not trying to change the subject at all. It's just a fact. We are so set on listening to three or four white folks, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, you know, on the news, giving them all this power, and we can't even pay attention to what's going on in our backyard so that maybe we can have one of these young black kids to be a president someday in their life. You know what I mean?
Well, maybe
it's sickening.
Maybe. Well, I think you kind of preach it to the choir, because you should be telling your fellow Republican homies and other constituents that they should be the ones that should be getting pissed off. Because listen, most of us, especially the black folks that I know, we are extremely concerned about how our kids aren't being educated in Minneapolis public schools. But again, what happens is the Republican Party decides to only look at black and brown people as Democratic votes and disregard them. They don't pour money. They don't pour resources. They don't even come into the black community.
You are absolutely correct. You are absolutely. We are on the same page on that, Mr. Nelson. And I have point blank told the chairman, the deputy chair. Matter of fact, all three of us, me, you, and the deputy chair, were on the radio. And point blank,
this is true.
When you ask Chris Fields, another black Republican, about diversity, what does he talk about? He said that Carly Fiorina was in the race. That makes diversity. Okay,
and
so
Dr.
if you
Carson,
have that
they
kind
like
of,
to...
Dr. Carson, yeah. So if you have that kind of mindset, what good is it going to do me standing on the top of the IDS saying the Republicans need to do this, this, and that, and they're $101.5 million in the hole? Not going to happen. You're absolutely right on that point. I can't argue that.
I think that,
well,
listen,
gentlemen, let me just throw this in because okay. I'm on the sidelines listening. Wow, this is interesting. It, I think, shows the spirit and the spunk and the passion of what's going to be 2016. I just hope that we can keep it halfway civil. So let me say something as it pertains to the Democrats. And I'm, you know, this is Ron Edwards from the left. I became aware of a report that was issued in January by the Governor's Committee on Diversity and Inclusion. He created a council under the leadership of three of his commissioners, including Kevin Lindsay. We all know Kevin Lindsay. Now, Kevin Lindsay was on a program on KMOJ on Sunday, and he was talking about what a wonderful job, you know, OIC was doing, and he praised Robbie Norman, and he praised Brother Louis King and others. And he was talking about just how great things were. And I remembered him being on that same program about 5 months ago, and he was talking in terms of how wonderful the state of Minnesota, under a Democratic governor, was doing with regards to awarding contracts and et cetera to entities that are, you know, minority business enterprises properly certified. Well, what was interesting to me was that in the document that was issued in January, which people now are telling me they're having a hard time following, there was a total, and this is something, Don, that you and I think it was Lenny Chisholm talked about a couple years ago, and I know Louis King became upset with you guys because he was talking about getting a contract on the construction of the Loring Bridge. And this was after everybody told stories about how many black folk and how many contracts were awarded for for Target Field and TCF Stadium. Now, in this report issued in January of this year, under the auspices of the Commissioner of Human Rights, it showed a particular category in which a little over almost $74 million in set-asides were paid out in 2015. In fact, the statement is actual payment of monies and et cetera. And, of course, the top group, first of all, by numbers, as it pertains to businesses that are certified under the set-aside program, of course, were white women, about over 600. White female firms certified to do business. I think, in fact, the figure is 643. The second was African Americans at 149. And the next was Asians at 104, and then everybody else was in, you know, just double digits. What was stunning to me, and we had been talking about this on these programs, and of course, Mr. Nelson has joined us in these discussions. M has joined us in the discussion. James, Brother James, and others have talked about it. But let me give you a figure that I just cannot explain how anybody can explain. Now, the total amount of set-aside monies, $1,700,000. Okay, I mean, if somebody wants to call in and wants the specific figure and quote, I mean, I'll give that to them, but just for the purposes of flowing, over $1.7 billion. Now, as I said before, almost $74 million of that allegedly paid out to certified firms under the minority set-aside. Now, the largest group, of course, were white women at $39 million. The next group was Asians, if you will, and remembering that Asians are only the third group as it pertains to certified groups. And then it went on to, Mr. Allen, even your veterans were over $1 million and et cetera.
Yeah.
What was disappointing, the lowest group, gentlemen, is identified as indigenous, which obviously must mean American Indians, at 73,000. Mm-hmm. 73,000 out of 73, almost 74 million. But the African American number, now this is a commissioner who happens to be black. He's on a black radio station talking to a black audience on a black program, okay, talking about how wonderful things are. Gentlemen, do you know what the amount was for the African American community on this set-aside program, these set-aside programs in the entire calendar year of 2015?
No.
$28,000.
No. $135,000.
Oh, okay.
$135,000. Now, by the way, for mathematicians and folks out there that always like to, you know, kind of call and say that we're just beating up on people, the percentage on that is 0.008. And any mathematician will tell you that when you get into those kinds of numbers.
And Mr. Edwards, I'm looking at the report. You have to
Report? You got the report there, Don? Okay.
Yes. And let me. It's so funny
you
bring that up.
Specifically, do you have page 19?
I have page 18 and 19. I'm looking at page 19 right now, or 18.
There you go.
Because
that's the page.
One of the things that you're saying is, well, one of the things that we as a black community should have a problem with is the community participation. The people who they had on the, with this group who are not going to buck the
system. They had people like the current chairman of the board of radio station KMOJ. They had Robbie Norman, right, Mr. Allen?
Yeah. Yes, Leah Hargett, Gary Cunningham, who else here? Robbie Norman, Dr. Samuel
I just
Myers.
Mentioned Robbie Norman. Uh-huh.
Alex Tittle.
Alex Tittle is our friend now, you know. We always make sure we put protection on Alex Tittle. Alex has been promoted to vice president of the facilities group. That was his reward for making sure there were no black people working on the project. Now, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Allen, over the last year, we've invited Alex Tittle at least four times to be on this program, and he has declined. Am I correct?
You are correct.
Okay. And that's the same Alex Tittle. So Mr. Allen is pointing out the Community Engagement Committee. In fact, if you count the numbers, you will see there are 36 individuals that were they're on that committee. In fact, at one point in the radio program on Sunday, The commissioner, Kevin Lindsay, tried to imply also, Mr. Nelson, Mr. Allen, that particular committee was also a committee that was dealing with the issue of public safety and the preparation for public safety information, which last week we had Dr. Porter of the name change Council of Black Minnesotans or whatever. Am I also correct on that, Mr. Allen? Because we can certainly call up and recapture
that
discussion with Dr. Porter last week.
Yes.
But Mr. Allen, Mr. Nelson, so that we're fair and balanced here, has the document in hand. He pulled it up, obviously, while we were talking. We looked at each other and nodded across the studio. $135,000 measly dollars out of $73 million.
Million.
Don, give us the actual figure, $73 million, and give us the rest of the number so our listening audience.
I'm going down to that page. Just a minute, Mr. Edwards. I had pulled up another report. So let me go back to that page here, and it's loading. So $73 million, and I thought I just saw it here. Just a second.
It's about $73,900,636.
43,936, it looks like. Yes, that's a rounding off.
Right. So, gentlemen, both of you are right in many regards. It's all a facade. People are just blowing smoke up the hindquarters of the African-American community and Native Americans and et cetera. It's really tragic what we see happening. And again, our phone lines are open, if you will. with regards to this. But Mr. Nelson, any other observations and questions? Because
if I may touch on another subject before I hang up here, and I'll hang up and listen, gentlemen. Mr. Edwards, I heard you on the radio on the conservative talk station the other day. You did a superb job. But
right.
So I wanted to ask a couple of follow-up questions real quick here. Now,
I'll take the time. We're going to be on for another hour.
on the radio station, on the conservative radio station, you had not indicated that you wrote a letter to VIA saying that the police department, that there was tampering with the Jamar Clark case via the police department. So is that something new that's come up about that?
No, in fact, I went to great lengths in both my column of the 28th of January in the Minnesota Post-Recorder, the largest and oldest African-American newspaper in the state of Minnesota, and I definitely went to great lengths in my letter, confidential letter, published by me last week after the story by the reporter Randy First, talking in terms of the case being sent back by County Attorney Mike Freeman to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which operates under the auspices of the Public Safety Committee. No, there has been no interference by the Minneapolis Police Department. Let's be absolutely clear, sir, and I appreciate you asking me that question and requiring me to clarify. No, my letter indicates that the questionable conduct, first and foremost, is centered around the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I specifically identify them in consultation with the Minneapolis Police Department. I shared with them the name of the investigator, the name of the person who is a member of the judiciary, if you will, and a couple of other names. But no, sir, at no point have I indicated that the MPD had anything to do with any impropriety or violation of the integrity of the investigation. In fact, in my letter to the Department of Justice, to the Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice, I identified in this sequential order the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the FBI, and the Department of Justice's Special Criminal Task Force, which is here investigating the allegation of additional violations of civil rights during the occupation. And so, sir, I hope that clears the air.
It absolutely does. I was just a little bewildered about that because I was wondering, you absolutely articulated it very well, but I wondered, was that a new development? So, at this point, are there any new developments with the case?
No, there are not any new developments, except there is a serious question, as it was at the time that the county attorney sent the case back to the BCA, is that they have not been able to produce the statement made during the week of the 15th of November by probably the key witness to the circumstances surrounding the death of Mr. Clark, including the last moments of his life on that early morning of the 15th of November. This witness was there. This witness, I thought, because I was present at his interview, the witness's interview, I thought the witness gave absolute concise information illustration and demonstration, if you will. In fact, 2 weeks ago, the witness and myself did actually a reenactment, if you will, of the witness's location on the night of the death of Mr. Clark. And I thought that the witness passed any kind of litmus test. Gentlemen, the witness's recollection and articulation of the events that he witnessed during the tragedy and the loss of the life of Mr. Clark was absolutely consistent with the statement that he gave the two investigators, one from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the other one from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And so this witness has maintained a strong and resilient response and consistency with what it is that the witness saw on that tragic night. Now, again, to your question, kind of repeating, being a little redundant, is that the only thing that is at play now is that no one can find the statement of the witness, if you will. And this witness was extremely crucial. Now, let me say this, sir, also, and I know that both of you gentlemen, by the way, I guess I'm kind of taking a shot at both of you here. Both of you are card-carrying members of the NAACP. Now, the NAACP, a week from last night, is to have their March meeting. They did not have a meeting in February. And I understand in talking to some other members of the NAACP that there has never been an update. Now, if I'm wrong, Mr. Nelson, because I know specifically you've been going to meetings, and Mr. Allen has contacts and et cetera, I understand that there has never been, since that fatal night, or that fatal early morning, basically 12:25, 12:30 a.m., there is... Gentlemen, there has never been a report made to the membership of the investigation and what is happening, how the witnesses are being handled, how the videos are being handled, how the statements are being handled, and et cetera. Now, am I wrong? Has there been under the agenda any report, an update on the role of the branch in the matter pertaining to Jamar Clark? Mr. Nelson, I guess not. I'm really putting the question to you, sir.
Mr. Nelson.
Are you still with us?
No, he was on a cell phone.
Oh, you got cut off. Well, Mr. Nelson, feel free to give us a call back. Don, I know that you have not been in any meetings, but I know that you know high-ranking officials of the NAACP. Have they indicated to you that there have been reports made? There is a report that citizens can access. And here's the reason I'm asking the question, Don, and the phone lines are open. I continue to ask the question based on my own long experience with these kinds of unfortunate cases, that custodial control and safekeeping of the evidence and et cetera is crucial. And here's where I'm troubled. And again, the phone lines are open for discussion. One of the things that is being said now in certain law enforcement and prosecutorial community is that the Negro community has been tricked, and that what the fallback position of the institutions, be it the county attorney, the BCA, or whomever, is that starting on the morning of the 15th of November, around 3 a.m., there were a number of individuals affiliated with the NAACP, Black Lives Matter, and et cetera, who were making statements and declarations that they had all kinds of witnesses, and they had people who had videos of the last moments, the last seconds of Mr. Clark's life. Now, what is being said within the prosecutorial community is that the African-American community hasn't delivered anything. Now, we know that the high profile end has been these continued attempts, and we see that a motion was filed in the Ramsey County District Court just, I think, Monday, demanding now again that the video, quote-unquote, of the incident that night. Now, I've known since day one that, as an example, the ambulance was not parked in a location that the video that they have on that ambulance would have captured anything. And the witness who gave testimony to the investigators has certainly clarified that by, again, the reenactment that we carried out 2 weeks ago. There's no way in the world that anything on the ambulance could have picked up the final moments of Mr. Clark's life. There's nothing on the other cameras. And The cameras across the street at the Ames Lodge weren't working, okay? So my question becomes, what are we going to do as later on as we go into the month of March when we find our community starting to come under attack, that we haven't produced anything and that clearly our responsible civil rights organizations misrepresented the facts about witnesses, videos, and et cetera. Are you hearing anything along those lines? And again, our phone lines are open.
Yes. Ms. Ayers, I am not hearing anything in regards to where the information is, who is the custodial guardian of this information, why haven't the videos been leaked? Because if there was, let's just put it like this, you know, these are hard times, Mr. Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a video, every major radio station would at least offer between $5,000 and $25,000 for that video.
Primarily, you mean TV stations?
TV stations. Radio, television, newspapers.
Okay, all right, the whole media,
The whole media would have offered cash money for that video. And I would like to announce right here, right now, if anybody has a video of the Jamar Clark shooting, drop us an email here. We'll negotiate for you with the television stations. Because I don't think there is a video like that out there, number one. Number two, I think that the NAACP, Black Lives Matter Minneapolis, are blowing smoke in the black community's face on this whole subject. And like you said, when it turns the other direction, which by history shows that it will, it's going to be ugly for some people, very ugly.
Well, I repeat again for our audience again, the phone lines are open, is that what is being said within the public safety community and et cetera, that the trap that has been sprung is to indicate that it would be impossible for a grand jury to reach any kind of decision. It would be impossible for a prosecutor even acting without a grand jury if there is no evidence. And yet there has been so much reflection and rhetoric that there was all of this evidence in the form of videos, eyewitness accounts, and et cetera. And I think that puts us in a very precarious spot as a community and puts in a very precarious spot those who are supporters of the African-American community in the quest for justice. I know that some NAACP members have asked Jason Soule, as an example, if he would clarify that he is comfortable as a person who is an adjunct professor, I understand, at Hamline, if you will, and a professor at Metro State, and says that he is well-versed with the law, as is the president of the NAACP and Black Lives Matter. That when the question is asked, are they comfortable that they are preparing these witnesses to appear before a grand jury, if by some legal miracle a decision is made that it won't be taken to a grand jury and they're going to charge the officers and it'll go to trial, that the witnesses are prepared and ready to take the stand, be it inside of a grand jury or inside of a courtroom with a petit jury, that these individuals are ready to present their facts, go into the court of justice, quote unquote, as we used to say, with their briefs. I, Mr. Allen, am just not getting a level of comfort that anybody has been working with the witnesses, anybody has been analyzing. Now, I assume that in preparation for a renewed motion, in fact, it was we here on this program a couple of weeks ago that raised the question about the lawsuit in light of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension turning their investigation over to the county attorney, that they would have to amend their lawsuit to demand that the county attorney, Mike Freeman, release the video. Now, Mike Freeman has already said concisely and even with some level of defiance that he doesn't intend to release anything until after this matter, quote unquote, is officially concluded. And so it raises the question, so what are our organizations doing to make sure that these witnesses are feeling comfortable, not threatened, and have been properly prepared? And I just don't, Mr. Allen, I just don't think that it's happening, and I think that it's going to be an easy out. If Mike Freeman makes the decision that he's not even going to take the case to a grand jury, he's going to make an executive decision that these officers will not be charged, other than a civil action by the family. And by the way, the city will make an offer to the family that is being prepared now to the family and the heirs of Jamar Clark. If the family accepts that financial package, and who would expect them not to, there will be a confidentiality agreement. I said it on my television program last Sunday. There will be a confidential agreement, if you will. The family will never talk about what happened and et cetera. And there will be no civil lawsuit. And, you know, within less than a year, we won't hear any more about Jamar Clark.
We sure won't. And we have Jamar Nelson back with us. And also we have another caller. Jamar, give me a minute. Caller, you're live on the air.
You know, gentlemen,
am I on the air?
Wait a minute, we have two people. Let us go, Mr. Nelson. Just hold for a minute. We want to get. I think the caller is M. We want to welcome M onto this discussion. So we'll just have a four-way discussion. M and Mr. Nelson, please stay with us because you're crucial. Because my question, and when unfortunately you disconnected. Was do you have any information, any knowledge? Is there ever been a report? But Mr. M, what is your observations?
Well, gentlemen, you know this is, you know, it's been such a perplexing situation, and I really appreciate you, gentlemen, really trying to dissect this and bring it to the public. But really, the only thing the public knows is what they see on the news, what they see in the papers, and what we've seen and heard is that there were witnesses on the scene. Okay, that when this event happened, there were eyewitnesses that saw what happened. They were there. They witnessed it. Okay? Now, in the February 24th edition of the Minneapolis Star paper, there's a big article on the front page, you know, with quotes from County Attorney Mike Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he says statements such as, it's not unusual at all to send things back and have additional investigation done, okay? Now, this article also says the BCA finished its investigation of Mr. Clark's death and gave the results to the Hennepin County Attorney's Office this month. Now, this was the month of February. So they finished their investigation. They gave the results to the county attorney. Well, why doesn't the county attorney share what those results were? See, what it reeks of is a situation where the county attorney didn't get the result that he wanted. So he either sends it back or he's just buying more time. I mean, this whole article is buying time. And then, out of the blue, Mr. Freeman goes on to say his mobility, he disclosed too that he had major surgery as he slipped on some icy steps and tore a ligament. He said his mobility was limited, would remain home, but he didn't know how long. Said the injury would not inhibit his work on the issue. Well, then why bring it up? Why bring it up?
Yeah.
I have put everything else aside. All my working time will be spent on this case. I mean, come on. I mean, this reeks of, you know, something
that
too high. If they finish their investigation,
geez.
Let's see what they had to say. Why can't we see what the BCA had to say if they gave it to the county?
Well, let me tell you the reason for that. Let me speak to that. The reason he's not going to tell you what they said because he sent the case back, and he maintains that all the pertinent evidence that may have required him to have made a statement is now back in the hands of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Which is a very clever move, and it takes the pressure off him as it pertains to what it was. Now, a couple of reporters, as I understand it, attempted to get the spokesperson, who was identified also in that article, to talk in terms of what it was that was lacking in what was sent over by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. But let's make sure we understand this. We have plenty of time here. We have 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. You got to remember, in that same article, sir, that you are making reference to, there is also a quick representation by the Star Tribune that when asking the federal government, the Department of Justice / FBI, who was the second investigative entity, the spokesperson for the U.S. Attorney and for the Department of Justice said what? Our investigation is not complete. And it's right there in front of you.
It is.
And so
it
compounds a lot of different situations and raises a lot of interesting questions. I would have liked to have had the county attorney indicate what it was that the report was lacking, but I'm familiar enough with law and the whole issue of, and gentlemen, I really seriously want us to consider this, the issue of due process and fairness to all parties, including the officers, if you will. And so in that, the attorneys for the officers, see, you don't hear anybody talk about the attorneys for the officers, have not had access to the BCA report. Now you're into the area, gentlemen, of what is called what? Discovery.
Yeah.
Now,
Mike Freeman
can hide behind the discovery issue if he would have retained the report and indicated that the next move was to take it to the grand jury, and he did not want to poison the well. He was being extremely clever when he, after less than a week, said, "Oh, I got to send this back. This is not complete," and did just that. He sent the whole package back to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Now, that's where I think, gentlemen, that the NAACP finally woke up and said, "Okay, we'll go back into Ramsey District Court and demand that the judge order the BCA to turn over the video and other information." Now, you got to understand, there was just a interesting situation in all places, Massachusetts, where a district court judge there, but this does not quote unquote have anything to do with the case here, indicated that a video had to be turned over, if you will. So I think you got to weigh how clever this is, and I'd like to know. Maybe you can get a call from someone other than Mr. Nelson and Mr. Allen, who is a heavy hitter inside of the NAACP, who can tell us what is their understanding of what was absent and lacking in that they have talked to all these witnesses and have seen all these videos, right? I'd like to hear someone. You know, it does no good to text each other about what are these guys trying to do. Pick up the phone and give us a call. Let your voice be heard.
I do have a question.
Go right ahead.
I mean, in this process, and I realize there's a bailed process. The whole grand jury process is a bailed process, which is shielded from the public. But we have been presented with the idea that the BCA is the authority, okay, that this was handed to them to look at, render some information as to what happened on that fateful day, and then take next steps. So, I mean, what the question begs to me is, I mean, who's really in charge? Does the BCA have authority?
But, sir, I have to say this. You got to understand that this thing was being done very clever from the very get-go when the Department of Justice indicated that the FBI and the MPD agreed to that and the DCA agreed to it, that there would be a joint investigation because the feds were going to be investigating. And you see, I saw it coming when I saw the press release by the last Tuesday by the county attorney when the Department of Justice said, yeah, well, that's well, that's all good and well. They can release anything they want to release because we have not completed our investigation. Don't you know what good attorneys will do with something like this if it there's an indictment by a grand jury before it even gets to trial?
Yeah.
I mean, this has been well thought out. Now, gentlemen, please give weight to what we have seen and what we are hearing that is being said about us as a community. That, you know, well, we were waiting on a lot of additional information from the Negros. And it didn't come forward. The videos didn't come forward that they had. They want to see our videos. We'd like to see theirs. Now, you know, none of us have said that in the 3 months that we've been talking about this. It's been in the back of all of our minds that you're talking about pro quo and tit for tat and all of that. But at what point does the government, both government entities, the feds and the states, say, well, Your Honor, we are filing the necessary motions to require the NAACP Black Lives Matter to reveal the names of their witnesses and to produce the videos. Now, I'd like to hear you gentlemen, because I've been talking, I'd like to hear your observations, if you will, starting with you, Em, and then you, Mr. Nelson, and my colleague, Mr. Allen.
Well, again, as I've already stated, I mean, there are eyewitness accounts. They know who these individuals are that were there, who were on the scene at that time. Now, they said, in the paper, it says right away, some witnesses say Mr. Clark was handcuffed at the time he was shot. Minneapolis police say, no, he wasn't handcuffed. He was reaching for an officer's gun. Okay, so you have witnesses that witnessed this event. And I think once you break down the witnesses' statements, only at that point can you tell where the holes are. I mean, right now it's two divergent points. Two people, like seeing an accident, a car accident. Okay, you get two, three, four, or five different versions from the same people that say they were there. I mean, this is the kind of thing that I think we're into now. There were witnesses there. Now, I do not know, and I don't think anyone really knows, what type of video exists, if any.
Oh, I have to disagree. There are people that know what kind of videos exist. In fact, I just touched on it earlier. And I have to say this as it pertains to the governor. There was a reason that the governor, who was really trying to, number one, end the occupation to maintain some kind of relationship with the African-American community. Let me just refer us also to the Minneapolis Star Tribune of December 1st, 2015. The headline was "Called to Stand Down as Charges Filed." It talked about the mayor and black leaders called for an end to occupation, citing unsafe conditions. Four men are accused of felony assault and shooting near protesters and et cetera. Your question, M, is extremely valid. But let me just ask this. Mr. Nelson, I mean, we've, you know, kind of made some critical statements and kind of, you know, moved towards you. Have you had any update at any of the meetings that you've been at, sir, that there's even a written report about this investigation and what M says, the witnesses?
In a word, no. Absolutely not. There has been no current factual statements of any witnesses or any updates on the case at all. I mean, thanks to the good work that you did, we found out that the young man may have been unconscious and probably likely not to have been handcuffed. But again, Madam President has said that, you know, the witnesses that she knows, they will not be coming forth. Now, before I got disconnected, I wanted to ask you, since you know of a very key and pivotal witness to this case, have the NAACP or anyone else reached out to you and asked you about your witness? Because, look, since he sent it back, now what's the next step, which I hope that we'll find out at the meeting, but what's the next step? What's our next step now that Freeman has sent the case back? What is that?
Well, let me just say, and I
appreciate
you because you're the first person that has asked that question, sir. And I appreciate it because there has not been a single contact made to me other than by the Star Tribune, by conservative talk radio, and et cetera. But as far as officials, either the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the FBI, / the Department of Justice, there hasn't been a single inquiry made to me about is this witness willing to come forward again, if you will. Let me repeat this so that everyone understands that one of the points that caused me to decide to make sure that the public knew back on the 28th of January that the investigation had been tampered with was when I asked the question of over a month after the interview took place, if the witness had been given a copy of their statement and had reviewed that, initialed and corrected any misspellings or et cetera, the witness said they hadn't heard from the investigators since that interview took place on the week of the 15th of November. And I said that in my column of the 28th of January, that's when I began to realize that this thing was in trouble. But no, sir, to your specific question, the NAACP, Civil Rights Leadership, has not given me a call and said, well, Mr. Edwards, can we meet in camera, in other words, behind closed doors, with the witness that you have? I repeat again, gentlemen, I'm afraid that you're going to be all greatly disappointed about all these witnesses that we were all told existed. And I do believe that a cake is being baked. I just hope that we don't get blindsided with this, but one of the worst things can happen is for Mike Freeman to stand up and say, well, you know, one of the problems that we ran into and the reason I sent the case back because I noticed an absence of people who initially we were being told were witnesses who there were no statements from, and when asked if they were prepared to give statements, they declined. Now, this, Mr. Nelson, goes to what you heard in a meeting in which there were at least 40-some or 50 people there, in which the president of the NAACP said that she was encouraging people not to come forward.
But again, I just have one more question.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is an event that happened right at the police station, right? I mean,
two blocks down the street.
More or less right at the police station. So, mm-hmm. I mean, to me, and maybe I've been watching too many crime shows, maybe I think we're all been kind of bamboozled by these crime shows anyway. But wouldn't they talk to all the witnesses there at the scene? Wouldn't witnesses be identified? Wouldn't witnesses be documented who was there? What did they see? Wouldn't they have asked them that then?
Here's what happened, at the time of the shooting. There were only two officers there when the shot was fired that killed Mr. Clark.
But within two blocks, there was a whole precinct.
Yeah, but that you're talking about 1 o'clock in the morning. It's embarrassing. There's no more than maybe 10 officers working the entire north side. Now, what happened, the squad cars that arrived were called from all over the city. That's number one. There were at some point there were at least 11 squad cars on the scene. Now let me just walk you through this, and I think it's very good that you've asked this question. When other officers arrived, these are uniformed officers. These are patrol officers, as well as a couple of supervisors who are sergeants. The first thing that they do, their protocol requires, is that they secure the officers and determine the condition of the victim, of course, in this case. And contrary, by the way, gentlemen, because we haven't had the kind of hard discussion that we should have, Mr. Clark was already dead, laying on the ground. The Star Tribune wrote a story back then. They've said it a couple other times. Others have said it, that he died the next day in the hospital. Mr. Clark was already brain dead. But at some point, a second ambulance was called. Mr. Clark was put in that second ambulance. That ambulance took off. The police began to secure the area because there was friction going on between residents and et cetera, some who had just woke up, some who had come out of the bar, and et cetera. Now, at some point, detectives homicide detectives arrived and detectives assigned to the assault unit. Now, some people say that some folks offered statements that they were witnesses. I don't know how good a job that the detectives did in securing names and identifications, but here's what did happen. By 7:30, gentlemen, that evening, 7:30 that morning, representatives of the NAACP, Black Lives United, and others were saying to the media that had shown up that they had all kinds of witnesses. In fact, a specific number was given on the morning of the 15th that there were at least 25 witnesses. Okay, now the commander of the precinct, I had some regards. I guess I'm not supposed to necessarily tell this, but I'm going to tell it because a question was asked by a longtime listener and a friend. The commander, Flitzhaven, came down to the Elks around noon. He was told by a young man, I'm not going to identify this young man, he knows who he was, indicated that he had video of Clark being shot in the head by a police officer who was standing with his foot on Clark's chest, shooting him in the head. Flitzhaven asked if that young man was prepared to make the video available, and that he himself would meet with him. Now, initially, they were to meet at the 4th Precinct. The brother in question, who is a member of Black Lives Matter, called and said that they weren't going to come to the station. It was hostile, and that they would meet somewhere else. The precinct commander said, "Can we meet at the Elks?" The precinct commander went to the Elks. There were a number of African-American activists, including some NAACP members and et cetera, who were there. The inspector, commander actually is his title, came to the Elks to wait on the young man and other members of Black Lives Matter. They never showed up with a video. Now, all during the remainder of the day, detectives and investigators were moving about the community, knocking on doors and et cetera. Gentlemen, you'd be surprised at the number of people that said they didn't know nothing about nothing. But still, the organizations during the next 4 or 5 or 6 days were saying that they had the videos, okay, that they had the information. They interviewed with CNN, with MSNBC, with CBS, with ABC, and et cetera, and they said they had video and et cetera. Now, that is an excellent question that M raises. How many witnesses were interviewed in the 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 hours after Mr. Clark was shot and killed? And how many of those names were made available once the investigation was turned over to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the FBI and the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice? How many of those individuals were interviewed? And, gentlemen, that's where I think we're all going to be disappointed. Okay, about how folks wound up, you know, not stepping forward or indicating that they heard something but they didn't see anything. And so that's a long response, but it's a damn good question. And I think it's one that the county attorney recognized that it gave him some leverage to say that the investigation was not complete. Now, let me repeat this again, and I'm open to any questions within legal parameters about the disappearance of probably one of the most significant witnesses who was within 16 to 17 feet looking directly at the victim and at the officers and et cetera, whose statement disappeared.
Well, you know, I don't believe in magic. So, you know, I mean, there were people that were there. Why this, they don't come. I mean, it makes you think that some type of muzzle has been put on people somehow. I mean, I don't know how. I mean, I am not privy to all the information that you are, Mr. Edwards, and you, Mr. Allen. But, I mean, and just in looking at this from the outside in, I mean, it just it doesn't look like it's an above board situation at all. I mean, everything that they say, I mean, you look at the articles, I mean, injuries to the county attorney and he's hurt and he can't. I mean, all these are diversionary type tactics to, you know, if that wasn't important, why even mention that? You know, if all his working hours are focused on this case, as the article said, well, why even mention that? You know, you have other people in the county attorney's office. He's not the only person that works there.
Oh, he has a very large staff. Yeah.
Oh, you know, I mean, I guess I just think it just looks, sounds as phony as two left shoes to me. And I'm not sure how, at least in my observation, how they're going to be able to turn this thing around without being transparent. And that's the one thing that they're refusing to do, is being transparent. They're hiding behind legal shadows that, you know, the public doesn't understand the grand jury process. They know that. You know, anything that they say, well, it's pretty hard to refute because nobody's been involved in that type of process before. So, I mean, it's difficult, and I just encourage, you know, you and Mr. Allen to continue to stay on this to see if somehow the closet door is opened up on it. I certainly hope it is. Justice to the family.
Don't worry. That is absolutely certainly my intention. But let me just say, as because we still have 17 minutes, this is an extremely important issue that very well could determine the level of volatility that could grip this city once the county attorney makes his determination. Mr. Nelson, any questions by you as a member of the NAACP?
Well, what I advise Madam President is to stop discouraging witnesses and obstructing any type of justice, and I hope she's not purposely doing that. Listen, I think that she would be wise to contact you to figure out the vital and pivotal witness that you know, and maybe you guys could coalesce. I think, look, we have to have a united front. If she's acting in the best interest of the Clark family, which in my opinion she is not, but since she is pretending to be the champion, then if she's now obligated to do the right things to make sure that justice is served, and not her style of justice, but real justice, to ask serious questions that I haven't seen her asking now. Before, she hasn't come before the cameras now since he sent the case back. She hasn't come before the cameras now to ask the serious questions as to why, how, and or present other witnesses to refute sending the case back or anything that he's saying. So I just encourage her, you understand, to start communicating with not only members of the NAACP, but the community, and working with those that are willing to work with her so we can bring this family real justice.
Right. Mr. Allen, any questions that you may have in your observation? And also, by the way, we don't want to cut anybody out. Is there anyone that is holding, that is on the line, that has any questions of us and specifically of me? Because I don't know, gentlemen, I hate to say it like this, it looks like I may have been the only person at this particular point that went in with a witness and heard that witness's testimony and saw how that testimony was handled. But, you know, that does not prohibit me from sharing with community some of the observations I made during the course of not only the testimony but information that I had prior and after this situation. But do we have anybody that is online, Mr. Allen?
No, we don't. We have a bunch of people in the chat room, but no one is calling in. But again, the number is 347-426-3904.
Okay, all right then. Anything else from you? Because you've been pretty hard hitting, and that is certainly appreciated by me as I've watched what has happened here with this so-called investigation. Any additional questions, observations about the events that particular night? Let me say this to generate continued reflection. I have said on a number of occasions that it is my feeling, based on knowledge that I have and testimony that I have heard, that Mr. Clark was unconscious at the time that he was shot. Now, on the conservative radio program, which I think, Mr. Nelson, you indicated that you heard me make that statement, and I made it on my television programs and et cetera, people on one hand seem to be surprised, but on the other, if they read reports out of California, if you will, and to really analyze what happened out there that night, they would maybe understand what is being said, that Mr. Clark had been rendered unconscious.
Interesting.
Well, I just cannot get away from the fact that there were people that saw this happen. I mean, and I know we live in a world now with video and camera, but that wasn't always the case. I mean, an eyewitness account carries weight. And I don't care what anybody says. Someone that was there and can be corroborated, a statement that can be corroborated by other individuals also there, I mean, that carries weight.
Let me say this on that, because this is another facet that all of a sudden has disappeared. Do we all remember the young child who had been in the home? The mother was, remember, taking a bath when her son came to tell her that somebody had been shot.
Yes.
You remember there was a lot of publicity. In fact, they took him. Mr. Allen, you're into the education. What is the name of that house that they take young children to when there are problems with emotional?
St. Joseph's.
Well, don't you remember for about a week, man, we saw this young child. In fact, it was Angela Davis of WCCO that interviewed him, and I thought it was a mistake on their part to have shown his face, if you will. Do you notice we've not heard anything about that child since probably the 21st, 22nd, 23rd of November, just before Thanksgiving?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's extremely interesting, because that was one of the few witnesses that really stepped up and indicated. But I have to repeat again, the young man who told the inspector of the 4th Precinct that he had witnessed it and he had video and et cetera, and when asked to produce it, he did not. Also, gentlemen, I have to say that another person who really should know better actually said at one point on the early morning of the 15th that they were there, and within seconds after the shot was fired, they turned their head and saw Mr. Clark in the last movements of his death. That person, I have to tell you, that person wasn't anywhere close to the scene. Wasn't anywhere close. In fact, the person was approximately 3 blocks away on Irving.
Again, the story says that there was a young lady there that was being administered to.
That was the girlfriend.
Young man, Mr. Clark interfered with that, them administering to this young lady that he had a situation with, from what the account says.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I mean, you've got ambulance personnel. It just sounds like when they recreate this scenario in my mind that there was a lot of people there. Now, that might not be true.
Absolutely.
But it
like there was a little confab
like,
going on. Yeah.
It sounds
well, there was
like
a party
a
going
lot
on in the house. That's where the incident took place. Let me say, because as certain questions are raised, I'm going to respond based on the information and intel. The position of the medical personnel was that they had forced Mr. Clark away from the ambulance. In fact, it was they that made the call for additional police backup, because they maintained Mr. Clark's demeanor. What happened was, at the time that Mr. Clark was shot, the doors to the ambulance had been closed and secured, if you will. And so the two paramedics are going to testify that they did not see the incident. They did not see the shooting. In fact, one of the paramedics, and this is supposed to have been kept confidential, we will now speak on it. One of the paramedics had given a statement that he had briefly scuffled before the police arrived with Mr. Clark.
Yeah, but again, if the ambulance was closed, and well, what's the threat to the person? There's no more threat. I mean, there's.
No, you raised the question.
He was interfering with that process of administering medical.
Here's what happened. When the police were in the process of arriving, and after they arrived, the ambulance personnel said that Mr. Clark had been the one that had injured the young lady, and so consequently the police went back towards the apartment, secured him, and were bringing him back towards the ambulance when the events took place. I mean, just to give clarification, because your question's a good one, it's the kind of question that should have been, I assume, has been dealt with by the investigators.
Investigation would clear that up in people's minds. See, there's so many loose ends. This is why this continues to be a volatile back and forth kind of a thing. All these loose ends, they refuse to do anything to clear them up. I mean, and again, I'm not in that milieu of work. I mean, I'm outside of the periphery, so I'm just a concerned citizen.
Yes, yes. Mr. Nelson, do you have any observation on that particular question? Because, again, I'm just kind of putting a little pressure on. I would have assumed that the NAACP, working closely with Black Lives Matter, have conferred on this and would have answers for us tonight. Certainly the phone lines will be open a week from today, or maybe they can
sure
do it
will.
Tomorrow night on Ms. Jones' program on KMOJ.
Mr. Clark went to sleep on us, Mr. Edwards.
Not Clark, you mean
Nelson.
You said Clark, Mr.
Yes.
Nelson.
I sure
go ahead, Mr.
Nelson. I was reading something here, so I'll share that with you in a minute. But go ahead.
If any place, that's probably a place that she would drop a bombshell would be on Lissa Jones' show. But other than that, no. I just simply encourage her to do the right thing, man. And I hope that we get some answers. Maybe we'll get some answers next week. I certainly will let you gentlemen know if at the meeting there's anything, of relevance that they mentioned. But I highly doubt that. So we'll soon see. Maybe she'll prove me wrong.
All right. All right, gentlemen, thank you, M. And Ms. Nelson. I want to thank you for taking the time to spend this time with us. By the way, again, for transparency, phone lines have been open. Anybody is welcome to call, to examine, to question.
And as I sign out, this is M, as I sign out, I do at some point I would like to talk to you gentlemen about a situation with our county child protection system. And it deals directly with the situation with Native Americans. There was an article a few months ago about, as we know, there's a law. Native Americans have established a position where they can have a say in what happens to their children that are in out-of-home placement. And there are some people that are aggrieved by that and think that they're not capable of making good decisions and want to take that away from them. And I guess I have some real serious thoughts on that, as this is something that the Native Americans fought for long and hard, to have a say on what happens with their own people. And I think that even the notion of going back and taking that away from them is pretty misguided. So that's at some point I'd like to...
We will work on doing that as soon as possible, because I've been hearing the same narrative. Was that you, Mr. Allen? Go ahead.
Yeah, that was me, because it's funny that he brings it up, because HF 1353 that flipped the Council of Black Minnesotans to the Council for Minnesota's African Heritage totally disassembled black people even having a word edgewise in the placement, in the out-of-home placement of our black children. Carolyn, State Representative Karen Lane, Columbia Heights, SB 41, was the author, along with State Representative Ren Moran and Senator Sandy Pappas, who totally took away the councils or the Black Minnesotans' overview of affirmative action on the state, and also the adoption, the in-home placement, that whole series of stuff where our children are winding up with white families that don't know how to comb the girl's hair. Okay?
Absolutely.
She goes out the house looking crazy. Okay?
Yeah,
and
but,
so
well, these are things
we need to look at that.
We really do. There's things that don't get on the radar. They happen behind the scenes. They happen, you know, where you don't know what happens until you get involved in those situations, until that system, and you're really blindsided and ill-equipped to maneuver through it. So I think that giving a voice to, you know, families should have a say, and I'm really concerned about the Native because, see, that would set a huge precedent because they went through hell and high water to get that right, to say what happens with their kids. They have to weigh in with them. And
yes,
so
I remember some of the African-American women who marched with them at the state capitol in that battle royal. In fact, if we can get Clyde Belcourt
to come on and talk with us,
I will try to talk with Clyde. I know his health has not been the best here over the last year, but if we can get someone like Clyde Belcourt or a person that he would recommend, I think that that's a issue that needs to be talked about because I'm hearing the same thing you are, Em. A lot of people are disturbed about how black children, black babies are being handled by this system. Yeah. All right. I want to thank both of you again, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you.
Take care. Thank you. All right. Mr. Allen, I will attempt to reach out to Mr. Belcourt and the American Indian Movement and see if we can find a appropriate person with the necessary knowledge to come on in the next couple of weeks to kind of update us because what M has said is consistent with the troubling expressions that I hear being made by people who are familiar with the system, be it adoption, abuse, or et cetera. So any final callers? We're down to the last 3 minutes, Mr. Allen.
Yes. There's no callers on the line, and our phone lines are still open the last 3 minutes, but you should have called earlier if you have something to say now. And we will be back, you know, of course, next week. Yeah, and there's I guess we'll give an update on the Camel J thing next week because I'm waiting on some more intel, which
well,
I have to talk
I can
to you
tell
about.
You this, and we would certainly like to have gotten to it, but there are matters that take precedent, particularly when you have people calling in. Kevin Qualls, the manager of KMOJ, general manager of KMOJ, and a man who is being touted as having done a tremendous job of keeping KMOJ going, is still serving his suspension, if you will. I think he is in day 15 of that suspension. I understand he still has 15 days left. The board will, I assume, make some kind of determination, if you will. And again, for those that are interested, the chairman of KMOJ's board of directors, which still is not legally constituted, is the general counsel for the Minneapolis Public School District, Mr. Frazier. Yeah, who is also on that committee, Mr. Allen, that you talked about. Go back, take a look, page 19. Am I correct? And
you're
there
correct.
Is Mr. Frazier, Cedric Frazier. Yeah. He is a member of the so-called community engagement group. I just kind of like to get his feel about, you know, if Mr. Quarles is going to be allowed to return to his position at radio station KMOJ.
That would be very interesting.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Well, let James Brown take us on home, and we'll...